Hi, my name is Amy.
And my name is James.
And this is How I Learned to Love Shrimp, a podcast about promising ways to help animals and build the animal advocacy movement.
Today, we speak with Monica Chen, the Executive Director of the New Roots Institute, formerly known as the Factory Farming Awareness Coalition. And we speak about several pretty big topics: theories of change for the animal advocacy movement, why collaboration between organizations isn't always easy, the importance of focusing on changing culture and social norms, as well as the difficulties around management and organizational leadership. In my opinion, Monica is a rare organizational leader who spends lots of her time thinking about what we can do that benefits movement as a whole. So it was a real pleasure to speak with her about these topics and pick her brain. As a small shameless plug, if you enjoy these episodes, we'd really appreciate you rating them on your podcast provider of choice, such as Apple Podcasts or Spotify. This helps other people find our podcast, which is very important when you have an esoteric and slightly weird name like ours.
This episode is sponsored by Animal Charity Evaluators, or ACE for short. ACE is a leading non-profit organization that uses evidence and reason to serve people who want to help animals. Trillions of animals experience extensive but avoidable suffering every day. That's why ACE conducts rigorous evaluations to identify and recommend charities that can reduce animal suffering to the greatest extent possible. I'm really excited to share that they've just released their highly anticipated 2023 Charity Recommendations, the go-to source for strategic giving decisions. With one gift to ACE's recommended charity fund, you'll support many of the charities represented on our podcast, such as Wild Animal Initiative, Shrimp Welfare Project, Faunalytics, and Synergia Animal. You're ensuring that your generosity goes where it matters most. So, if you want to make a meaningful difference for animals like pigs, chickens, and shrimp, visit animalcharityevaluators.org. Your support could help change the world for animals.
We are joined today by Monica Chen, who's the Executive Director of New Roots Institute, formerly known as the Factory Farming Awareness Coalition. And their mission is to empower the next generation with knowledge and training to end factory farming. Welcome, Monica.
Thanks so much for having me, James.
No worries, excited to talk to you. It is sadly our first episode without Amy, so I will do my best to keep this ship on track. So do you want to tell us a bit about your background and how you got into working at the New Roots Institute?
I think that what's really important to just understand about my background is that I really cared about animals as a child and was really horrified when my uncle was talking about eating the guinea pig that I had. It really bothered me. And it made me understand, you know, how social norms really impacted people and how masculinity and culture all played a role in how we're treating animals. Then when I met my first vegetarian in seventh grade, I became vegetarian. When I met my first vegan, I became vegan. When I met my first activist, I thought that I could do this too. So really understood the purpose of the network. When I graduated from college, the animal rights movement was much smaller. And there just weren't that many opportunities. So I became a third grade teacher. I ended up teaching more environmental education, working in LGBTQ outreach, and then mental health and suicide prevention, and then working in prisons, teaching college classes, where I was still able to connect to factory farming. So all of that led me to New Roots Institute.
Nice. And do you want to give us I guess, the overview of what New Roots Institute is and what you guys, like, the main work is?
Sure. So New Roots Institute builds capacity for the movement to end factory farming. We do this by working in high school and college classrooms around the United States, and we're set to reach about 50,000 students this upcoming academic year. And from all of those really unique lessons, we're recruiting students, the most motivated ones, to join our fellowship program. It's a competitive program, and this year we had about 200 fellows from the spring and summer semesters working on campaigns, learning about the impacts of factory farming, and they did their project work with our partner organizations, which is really exciting. And all that is practice for what they're trying to do in their careers, whether that's, you know, advocating in mission-aligned and adjacent organizations, governmental bodies, and corporate spaces.
Mm. And so when you say you reach 50,000 people, so there's some element of New Roots Institute staff going to give talks in classrooms, and this is like high school and in college, is that right?
Yep, they're Socratic style seminars, so it's really unique and based on the class. Obviously, what happens in a ninth grade health class is very different from what happens in an MBA class.
Mm, cool. And if I'm not wrong, you also train up students to then
give these talks themselves, right? So it's not just your staff doing it, it's people you're scaling up, or students you're scaling up to keep doing it. Is that right?
Yes. The 50,000 students that I'm speaking about are the ones that just our lead educators are working with. But yes, our actual students are working with the local student body. And that's really exciting, actually, for the fellows to be working on campaigns, doing the education. And because that student body is so primed for this, the campaigns are more likely to be successful.
Cool. Wait, so if I got that right, so there's like New Roots Institute lead educators, part of your staff, that them alone are reaching 50,000 students. And then there's the additional trained fellows who are reaching even more than, but you guys don't track that. Is that right?
We are tracking that. I'm excited to see how many they reach this coming year, and then I'll be happy to report on that.
Cool. Okay, exciting. Looking forward to it. I'll have you back on in a year, and then you can tell us. Cool. That's very cool. And how come the key focus on, I guess, young people and building capacity through young people rather than any other group of people?
Well, what I've really learned is that in schools, students can't go away, right? People can't just leave, and they can't just scroll past you on social media or skip through a news article. So this is really an environment where you have the full attention of these students, and they have to listen to you because they'll get tested on it later. And that's really just something that we can take advantage of. It's not as easy to reach adult audiences and get them to focus with that level of intensity. And we're talking about the next generation. We're thinking about all of the strategies that we work on as a movement, whether it's corporate campaigns, political outreach. It just benefits from having people on the inside who have that anti-factory farming lens. So I think it's really critical that we prep this next generation to work in those spaces.
Mm. And that's the point of the fellowship program. So it's people who are like, maybe we've been involved with other programs, like particularly committed, and then they get training to be an activist and more engaged. Is that right?
Yep, they learn about the impacts of factory farming so that they can go and speak to the sustainability directors on their campuses and share the relevant facts, learn how to motivate other people and talk a lot about influence. And the key thing to recognize is there is no animal rights class in high school, right? We're recruiting these students from an environmental science class or a poli-sci class. They are going to go and work in a lot of different spaces, not just within our movement. And I think that's really key for us to grow our movement beyond just us.
Yeah, that makes sense. And the students end up doing campaigns locally in schools, things like default veg or plant-based campaigns. Is that also right, if that's the kind of stuff they're interested in?
Yeah, the project partner organizations like the Better Food Foundation, PCRM, they pitch to our students, and the students get to choose what campaigns they work on.
Nice. So yeah, I think it's very cool because it's like this nice pipeline of you reach a broad range of students. Some of them are particularly interested, like really capable and really want to do more stuff. And you connect them with a bunch of different promising NGOs across a range of campaigns. And then they kind of pick and choose what appeals to them. And then they kind of pursue that. And so they become a pipeline basically from like young students to hopefully seasoned campaigners and activists. Is that right?
Yes, we're very much trying to be a hub for all the other animal rights movement organizations to have access to these students.
Nice. That's very cool. And I think there's something quite interesting in your strategy document on your website. I think, first, I think it's interesting because I think it's the only theory of change or strategy document I've seen that has what's called like a systems diagram. So it has feedback loops and it has a pretty like, I think, interesting or not just linear theory of change. And yeah, do you have any thoughts on that, on why that's something you wanted to include and why you think that's important?
Yes, and feel free to critique this as well, James, because the big challenge for us when we're working on a theory of change, right, is that we want to make it understandable. But to end factory farming and to show all these feedback loops is very complex. So what we did was we put together this diagram, and then we also included a decent amount of text as well, which I think is key. So you can let me know about the understandability of this document.
Oh, I think it's great. And yeah, I'll link it in the show notes so everyone else can have a look at it. It's on page 15, I believe. And it's, yeah, I think a key part of your work is about shifting cultural norms and social norms and behaviors that kind of uphold factory farming. And I think that's not something, at least I've seen lots in other organizations. And yeah, do you have a sense of why do you think that's a particularly neglected area in terms of like cultural norms, and like what does that even mean, and what does that even look like to be changing those kind of things?
Yeah, I think that if you can change social norms, you can do anything. The challenge is that so much around culture shift is very difficult to measure. I get asked, and I've told you this before, I get asked on a daily basis, what year are we going to end factory farming, Monica? And it's an outrageous question. And I could make up a number, but I'm not that kind of person. I'm not just going to lie. I think that the real question that people are trying to ask me is your strategy working? Because it's tough. We read stats such as per capita meat consumption is rising, or the number of animals being slaughtered is still around 10 billion animals, right? It's devastating to, and I mean that in the United States, it's devastating to have that kind of information. So you and I have talked about comparing it to something like the environmental movement, where we can recognize that carbon emissions are continuing to rise. At the same time, there have been really big cultural shifts, and those cultural shifts are key for policy changes, are key for corporate commitments, etc. So really, like, trying to measure our success as a movement by some of the culture shifts that are happening, I think is really key.
Yeah. And yeah, I think we spoke about this a bit with Carolina, because I think she was had the pretty pessimistic view that, you know, factory farming is getting worse and worse, like you were saying. And yeah, I think something that came to mind, we spoke about briefly, was exactly that. It's, even though carbon emissions are rising, very few people would say the climate movement isn't having like a pretty significant impact on the world. And, you know, their capacity is growing, and maybe the rate of increase of carbon emissions is slowing, but still positive. So it's interesting to think of our analogies as, maybe it's unreasonable even yet for us to think animals killed will be going down. So it's like, what are some other relevant metrics? But anyway, yeah, this is a whole big topic that maybe it'd be nice to talk about a bit more. But yeah, I guess in terms of, do you have any ideas of what these cultural shifts would look like, or what are some examples of things like maybe you guys focus on and how you guys measure your own impact?
Well, what's so fascinating about the impacts of factory farming is that it touches on everything. We can go to pretty much every single class in a high school and college and connect it to something, right? If we're in a business class, we can talk about horizontal and vertical integration. If we're in a healthcare class, we can talk about zoonotic diseases, et cetera, right? So when we're thinking about all the areas that make up culture, I'm thinking about some pretty broad categories. In terms of media, I'm thinking about, in television, is it possible for us to start keeping track of the number of vegan characters that there are in television? And that's like not the central weird strange thing, that they just are vegan, right? In healthcare, we have doctors prescribing plant-based diets, or vegetable prescriptions, as they call it, right? In cafeterias around campuses, not just in schools and businesses, but everywhere, is the default veg? When you go into Pete's Coffee or Starbucks, is oat milk the default? Are men who identify as strong and masculine eating tofu, right? That represents a big cultural shift. So these are the things that I think make up, and that's a short list really, but these are the things that make up our culture. And in our lessons, we ask the students, why do you eat animal products? And while taste is a huge piece of this, price, you know, what's available, the culture, we keep on coming back to the culture. And that's why I know this matters so much.
Yeah, I think maybe people have seen a good piece of work by Jacob Peacock from Rethink Priorities, kind of looking at this hypothesis called the taste, price, and convenience hypothesis, basically that when we have alternative products, animal products such as plant-based meat or cultured meat that are, you know, broadly on the same level in terms of how much they cost and how good they taste, we'll have a wide-scale adoption of plant-based products and not animal products. And I think his view was that the current evidence doesn't support this. And one of the reasons was actually, you know, food is complicated. Well, humans are complicated, and actually social norms and culture is also a significant factor in what drives people's day-to-day, I guess, food consumption. Is that broadly the kind of view you have, is like these things are important, but actually social norms and culture is another bit of this puzzle that is relatively less like looked at or understood?
Yeah, and I did read Jacob Peacock's article pretty closely, especially because he's an advisor to New Roots Institute. And what I found so fascinating was in the article was about how we've been sort of reliant on blind taste tests to really reinforce that, oh, people would be eating this plant-based burger And find it just as delicious. And because it's in front of them, it's theoretically, you know, the same price in terms of accessibility. And we do know that people don't just exist in life, like doing a blind taste test. If you're up at a cafeteria window and you're choosing what you want to eat, there is so much that goes into like your history with your connection of, you know, like I eat meat to be strong, and, you know, eating meat protein, like that's the healthiest. And there are so many industries that are working to push certain narratives. And without us doing that education, without us influencing that culture, we'll just be victimized, I think, by the strength of some of those narratives.
Definitely. Yeah. And obviously, like the animal ag industry has been the, you know, dominant player. It's, you know, like a $1 trillion enterprise with lots of marketing at its disposal. And it's kind of run all these campaigns. So it has really like kind of fed into our narratives. And how do you think are the ways we actually shift those things? And if we agree that, you know, this is a big problem, this is neglected, we should work to change it. Yeah. What's your view on how we can actually influence that realm of kind of like culture and social norms?
Well, first of all, each of us is uniquely positioned to create change within our communities. And sometimes in our lessons, I'll give the example of, say, there's a Burger King right next to your school and you go there all the time with your friends. If you order the vegan Impossible Whopper after this lesson, what message does that send to your friends? If several of your friends order the vegan Impossible Whopper, what message does that send to everybody else? And conversely, if all of your friends order the vegan Impossible Whopper, if you're truly honest with yourself, how comfortable do you really feel ordering the meat burger, right? And I think that's important because so many times when we do what's called, categorized as like individual diet change outreach, it's about like the number of lives that you're saving. And, you know, we can speak very candidly here, right? Like you being vegan, James, doesn't automatically mean that like 10 cows were saved, right? But there is power in the influence that you have on others. And of course, like if you have, there's just this deluge of terrible information, right? Our students, this Gen Z is extraordinarily saturated with very bad information that leaves people feeling very hopeless. So James, your option would be to just do nothing, or you can try and do something, even if like you're not totally convinced that it's actually having like the direct impact of saving 10 cows. It's like, what kind of person am I trying to be? I'm the person who tries. I'm the person who influences others. And each of us, right, is going to be in some very different communities where we're able to affect change subtly, or maybe even very on a much larger scale. And so that's how I know we're going to affect change in terms of culture.
Everyone's like a node in a community, so you kind of play some significant or some role. And the idea is, how can you influence the kind of the nodes or the people in your immediate vicinity? And then once we have enough movement, then there's some kind of domino effect. Like you're saying, if you now become the minority eating meat products, suddenly you're thinking, oh, wow, maybe I should think more about this. So is the idea that how do we kind of get smaller communities to become like maybe primarily plant-based or whatever? And then that will kind of help things tip along.
Yeah, I want to shift the social norms. You and I have had conversations about the value of supporting some very like niche communities. I think you mentioned philosophers, yay philosophers, or animal rights philosophers, like all being vegan, right? You know, there that's where the conversation around low-hanging fruit comes in, right? You could be reaching out to, I don't know, the white girls on the coast in their 20s. You could be reaching out to the EAs. You could be reaching out to the people who love guinea pigs, right? Like that's the low-hanging fruit. What's key, though, when we're doing this outreach is that we're not just narrowing it to those people and we're saying like, oh, this is just for people who love guinea pigs. This is just for people who are rich, or this is just for people who are Democrats, because we need to make this part of the larger social norms. And one of the big challenges that we've had when we focus on such niche communities is that people then say, oh, I'm not a part of that community, therefore this doesn't apply to me. And that's led to a lot of stereotypes that definitely do impact our work when it comes to educational outreach and culture shift.
I don't want to take credit for something that was me. I think it was actually Aiden from Pax Fauna you're talking about, for context, Aiden from Pax Fauna, Pax Fauna generally have done lots of work thinking about social norms, and one of their hypotheses, I hope we're not giving away their master plan, is maybe what are some communities that are like particularly susceptible to pro-animal views? And one example was the punk scene, right? And that, you know, for some reason there's a huge like a really high rate of people in the punk scene either being vegan or being basically pro-animal. And once that kind of took off, it's kind of been like this long-lasting kind of community tradition. And the question then is, what are some other communities that are also susceptible to these kind of views? And I think Aiden's hypothesis is like academic philosophers, you know, that they're exposed to ethics about animals and they should be pretty amenable to the arguments and seeing if the same kind of mechanism works for them. Do you have any thoughts on that kind of hypothesis and any other like potential target communities that could be a good fit?
There are so many. I mean, last week I spoke to the Union for Reform Judaism, and I'm not even Jewish, but certainly after speaking with them, I could very much understand the connections between, you know, the beliefs and values and how that relates to not causing harms to animals. And I think that many people have identified religion as being a very guiding force that relates to ethics and could connect much more deeply to not eating animals any longer. And that is being pursued. There are many organizations that are working on this. I don't know to what extent we've been able to measure their success, though. That's really one of the challenges as always, right, is how do we measure the success? Is our strategy working?
Yeah, yeah. And I guess on that, so to be kind of devil's advocate, so what kind of comes next then? So let's say you have, you know, all the punks have gone vegan, all the academic philosophers have gone vegan, let's say, maybe the Buddhists and Jain are already vegan, but, you know, they've gone like ultra vegan, like become all very pro-animal, let's say. And then how does that translate to the wider population, the public, so people who aren't in this niche community? So how do these effects kind of spill out into the broader public?
Exactly. And that's why I think it's so critical for us to be doing our outreach in schools, right? When you go into a school, it's everybody, every single race, every single gender, every single religion, but you're finding those people who represent all those different communities. And it's key, right? I mean, I encounter so many young men who are just like, I've got to be big and strong. And Monica, you are not big and strong. Therefore, I do not relate to you in the same way that I would relate to one of your colleagues or to, you know, one of my friends. But if I can connect with just one of those friends or somebody else can, right? That's how you move the needle.
That makes sense. I think what you said at the beginning is also right, in that school is a place where, you know, you kind of have to, for better or for worse, be there and absorb the information. And it's a really diverse group of people. And maybe in terms of that, when you think about targeting, like, do you pick certain schools or certain programs for any reasons? Or like, how do you think about which schools you do actually work with?
Yeah, and this is a really important point, James, because when I first started working at what was then called Factory Farming Awareness Coalition, the pressure was for us to just reach as many people as possible for the lowest cost per person, which led to us, you know, just doing presentations. We don't even give presentations anymore. Like, we used to have set slides and we would follow those slides and basically say the same thing over and over again. And that doesn't work as well. Like, we know that pedagogically, it's much better for the students to come to their own conclusions, to really be engaging in dialogue, to really not just be using the slides as a crutch, but as something that can guide the actual discussion, which is really important. And that does represent a very big change for us. And now, as we work to try and reach 50,000 students this coming year, last year it was closer to 40, but this year I think that we'll get back to the pre-pandemic levels. We want to be really intentional. We want to make sure that the schools that we're working in are more of our high engagement schools where we have fellows working on campaigns. And ideally, and this is one of the big challenges in our movement, every single organization has, for the most part, been operating in a silo. We haven't yet coordinated and said, hey, let's all work in Denver because there's a slaughterhouse campaign going on and we want to make sure that their students are showing up and the schools are advocating for this as well. That's what I'm really excited for, that coordination. And in New York City, right, it is very powerful that there are folks like Mayor Eric Adams and Rachel Atchison working on certain plant-based foods initiatives on Fridays in these schools. How do we make sure that there are students who are actually supportive of it, parents writing in saying, just to keep that longevity, right? To make sure that it's actually having that desired impact. Because what I don't want to see is us focusing on just like a singular campaign win, right? Such as let's have all meatless Mondays in a company and it being executed very poorly, right? And that actually making it more difficult for us to do our larger goal, which is that we're trying to shift culture around eating animals and we want to move away from factory farming. So sometimes I worry we focus so much on getting like an individual win. We're not thinking about the broader, is this that going to then lead to something else? And that's what I'm hoping we can engage in dialogue about with every campaign that we're working on, is strategically place our students in those communities where we as a movement have thought about, is this campaign going to lead to something broader?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So there's something in there where you think we kind of focus too much on like individual campaign by campaign or win by win, or maybe like, let's say animal save, rather than thinking how will this next campaign feed into this longer term strategy of eventually kind of, let's say, toppling industrial animal farming. Is that broadly right?
Yeah. And for every single thing, I just want us to be thinking ahead into the future, right? So if I right now was in power and I just decided at my company, are doing meatless Mondays or in a school, that could really backfire if I just decree that. Even though the animal rights movement would be like, hooray, that was a win, I'd be concerned about the way it was rolled out. The messaging was were the cafeteria workers on board? Are they going to sabotage it? Is everybody now going to like have this very anti-vegan stance because the meatless Monday food is so bad, right? So and you can extrapolate this to many other things, right? Like if we focus on Chinese live animal markets as an example, and we focus so hard on closing a Chinese live animal market without bringing in the Chinese community, right? Are we really going to be set up to, even if we win and close down a single live animal market, is that setting us up for a future in which we close down all live animal markets? That's just the question that I'm asking. Like, can we be planning ahead more?
Yeah. And why do you think people are not doing this kind of long-term planning? Or do you think they are, but it's just not very common?
Well, a couple of reasons. One is I think that in the case of like the live animal markets, people feel very strongly and intensely to save like those animals that are right in front of them. It is very hard to, you know, extrapolate that further. People get very invested in it. And I also worry that we focus a lot on campaigns that reinforce an individual organization, right? So if there is a nonprofit that has like branded a very specific campaign, then the goal is to just grow, just have that exact same campaign adopted without necessarily the nuance of the specific community that campaign is now in.
So I think maybe one reason why this is not happening currently is because either, you know, it's very hard to predict, you know, the outcomes of our campaign on future campaigns, or this kind of collaboration with many stakeholders is very challenging. Even though our movement isn't very big in the big scheme of things, there's still a bunch of players and everyone has their own incentives. Like, what do you think is kind of like stopping the collaboration in terms of either, maybe I'll stop there. What do you think is stopping the collaboration happening more?
I think that historically, there's just been really limited funding. And there have been a lot of, again, like very passionate people who have wanted to see their organizations thrive. And sometimes there have been some issues with taking credit for certain things. Certain people didn't get along. And I understand that. And I have a lot of empathy for it. I also feel like I need to say very clearly that I have a lot of respect for like the Meatless Monday campaign, and I think they did great
Connecting
it to health. So please don't come at me for using that as an example. But I do think that we're in a really unique moment as a movement. I do know that our movement has grown significantly. I can recognize that there are people who have stepped into roles in organizations who have this, what I would call like movement-centric lens, where they're thinking about how to measure the success of the movement as opposed to just the success of their organization. And I think that a lot of more organizations are starting to specialize in some very specific work and find their niche. So they're, you know, like at New Roots Institute, as an example, we're not trying to be the entire movement. We don't do any of the policy work, the default work by ourselves, suing LAUSD. None of that we do by ourselves, right? What we do is so specific. We are working with high school and college students. We're preparing this next generation with the knowledge and training and factory farming. And so we do serve, we work with those other organizations, and that's very intentional.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes sense. And maybe we'll talk about the pros as well as some of the cons. I think that's also useful. What do you think we're doing good with regards to collaboration in the animal advocacy movement?
I think that it's really exciting to see some more capacity building projects taking place. I've been in some conversations to get, you know, all the operations directors communicating and working with each other. There are organizations like Animal Defense Partnerships, and I'm also an advisor to them, Scarlet Spark and the AVA Summit, that I think do a really good job of supporting other organizations right? So as an example with ADP, every single time I called a lawyer for every tiny thing, it was $400 an hour. For the funders to be supporting an organization like ADP, right? That just having like a few lawyers on staff that all the organizations could theoretically reach out to, I think it's a great idea. Scarlett Spark is working on HR and leadership, because these are things that I think get neglected when we're starting organizations. We're focused so much on the programmatic work. And again, we have some really smart, passionate people who are good at doing the programming. And then that has meant over the years that supervision has not been something that we've really invested in. You know, the benefits, like really setting up the structure for a nonprofit is very challenging to make the culture of that nonprofit really strong. Overall, yes, I'd say that one of the best things that we're doing in terms of collaboration right now are recognizing the areas in which we have been sort of spread very thin, and where us working together, like animal advocacy careers, right? The particular program that I support is, if Mercy for Animals hires a operations manager and they rejected candidates 2, 3, and 4, those candidates go into a pool. So then when we hire for an operations manager, we can see those exact same candidates. Saves us so much time, right?
Yeah, that's very cool. I'm sure the people there will be very happy to hear all your kind words. I think so. The kind of meta theme there seems to be kind of like, there's, I would say, a kind of meta or like service providers who provide benefit to a bunch of nonprofits who then kind of help animals. And yeah, I think another example, actually, I'm going to give a shameless plug to Amy because she's not actually here. She's actually doing something similar now, I believe. Like providing like campaign consulting to other groups who are doing corporate campaign work. So she's actually now has some funding to actually support groups in, you know, brainstorming how to campaign effectively, how to be innovative with your marketing and your actual kind of tactics on these people. So I think it's kind of cool that, yeah, funders have the kind of like, also that the movement-wide mindset to be, we'll support one organization who can then support many, and that's much more effective than or efficient than, yeah, except everyone has their own lawyer, everyone has their own marketing consultant, so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we'll scroll back a tiny bit to something we kind of maybe glossed over before, is like the longer term theories of change. And do you have something in mind for, if you know, if I was to put you on the spot and say, hey, Monica, what's your long term theory of change for how we end factory farming? What would you say?
Yes. So first of all, I want to make very clear that our organization does focus on ending factory farming. I do view that as a campaign. And I compare this to the LGBTQ movement, where we know that people really rallied around Freedom to Marry as a campaign, even though we knew that just because gay people can get married doesn't mean that all homophobia and transphobia disappears, right? But it's really a significant campaign. So I want to stress that, because so many people I know sometimes get really bogged down into like, we need to achieve all animal liberation. And I want us to get there, but I view us like focusing intently on a campaign like ending factory farming as being really key. That does not mean that I condone the pasture raids, et cetera, you know, all that kind of stuff. That's a lie. But really the number, when we step back, the number of animals, the scale of factory farming, if we can reduce that suffering, I think that that is huge. Like, there's nothing that we do as a human species that is worse than what we're doing with factory farming. So I want to make that really clear, and I want us to rally around that. And I want us to recognize that there are a lot of different interventions, right? Animal Charity Evaluators listed 16 interventions. I saw the Farm Forward report that was listing a similar number of what they would call strategies. And I think that it's helpful to see all of these. We need to know that they are running on different timelines. So something like alternative proteins, corporate campaigns might have much shorter timelines than some of the long-term culture shift changes. And we need to recognize that, you know, these timelines are different, and think about how these strategies are actually supporting each other toward that campaign goal of ending factory farming. And really, when I look at funder theories of changes, I appreciate how meta level they are. What I just don't see is what you were talking about in our theory of change earlier, which is just around these feedback loops around the social norm, right? So I'm really seeing that in our classrooms, where we have our students who are fellows, it's now much more, the whole student body is becoming much more supportive. And the more supportive that student body is, you know, it's an incredible feedback loop and gets us more fellows. So I'm really interested in looking at some broader theories of change that show how these interventions support each other and have those feedback loops.
Nice. That's cool. Yeah, I think definitely I agree with your initial kind of caveat in that, you know, ending factory farming is ending all animal suffering, but hey, it's pretty damn good. So I think if we can win that in like my lifetime, I'd be pretty pumped. that makes sense. So, but it also sounds like broadly your view is that there's kind of like no silver bullet. We can eat a variety of things. And also we should be kind of testing things iteratively. We do a bit of this, see if it has some positive spillovers or things going. And then we kind of reorient based on how things are going. Is it broadly right?
Yeah. And sometimes I worry that when I say that we need all strategies, people think that I'm in la-la land and I'm like, every organization and strategy should be funded equally at all times. That's not what I'm saying, but I am making sure that we value all these different strategies as supporting this larger shift. Yeah, and
yeah,
it would be ridiculous to say that one thing is going to be that silver bullet. And anybody who says that, I think, is just really lacking humble self-awareness.
Yeah. I don't know if it was Dave Cohen-Hardy said this, or someone said this. It was like, there are no bad strategies, only bad timing. That was a really funny quote, which I really like.
Mm.
And then coming back to the collaboration stuff as well, what are some promising collaboration opportunities that you think aren't happening right now, or some low-hanging fruit for people to help out with, or something that could be set up?
Well, one is that I think that policy work has just been sort of really siloed in our movement, and it hasn't connected to the grassroots outreach necessarily. So I'm looking at policy work that intentionally leverages our students, and that connects to some of our regional work. Right. So I want to be very intentional about where we deploy our lead organizers and lead educators and fellows. And we want to be working in collaboration with these other organizations. We cannot be everywhere. Right. We recognize that the resources are limited. So where do we all want to concentrate? And certainly there are some really key opportunities in places like Denver and New York, as an example, Chicago being another one. So I'm interested in us having some more conversations around regional work.
Okay. So then to get maybe a bit more concrete, because obviously I'm also not based in the US and limited understanding, would it be something like, let's say Humane Society of the US wants to do a bat initiative in like Denver or wherever, and you're like, oh, we work with schools in Denver, how can we link up, you know, our students with the campaign, and they do some door knocking and whatever. Is that the kind of stuff you're thinking about in terms of connecting both the grassroots and the NGOs and regional stuff?
Yeah, and Denver has a supportive mayor, and we have a lot of other organizations, not just the Humane Society of the United States, but we have. So what's really cool about our project work, right, is that we have students from all over the place working with a single representative from the Better Food Foundation on the default campaigns, and they check in very regularly with them. So it's really actually pretty easy for us to concentrate students in some specific regions without a whole lot of, like, BFF doesn't need to be on the ground in Denver, but it's certainly going to be helpful for more people in Denver to be consuming plant-based foods and you know, having awareness of, you know, this whole anti-factory farming lens. So I'm really excited about taking advantage of the fact that our movement has been working so remotely and there's so many organizations working on these strategies, but just trying to make sure that, like, we have the people on the ground in those regions.
Yeah, and you think the people on the ground are useful in the policy case, I guess, to meet with representatives and to make things a bit more concrete for policymakers so they kind of feel more pressure to actually enact good policies?
Yeah, and this is really where I think it connects to some of the issues that we've had as a movement with, like, focusing on such specific campaigns, right? So if you are not working with your community, right, and you're targeting something that's, like, very important to a specific culture or group of people, and I use the example of Chinese folks in the past just because, like, I am Chinese, and it felt like I could use this example. Yeah. If you don't connect with the Chinese people, then the representatives are not going to want to work with you, because now the whole Chinese population is very concerned about this, and it's seen as this issue that they cannot touch. So it's very helpful for us to be working with students on the ground who are Chinese, as an example. Like, and that, I know I'm using like a very specific campaign here, really what we need to be doing is thinking about this long term of, like, how are we going to work with larger communities and make sure that when we're working on an issue, that a congressperson feels that they have the support of the community. It's not them like sticking their necks out, right? That they feel like, oh, Overton window kind of stuff, right? Like they feel that this is actually something that the people want, and it's not just a singular person at HSUS who is trying to make this happen.
Yeah, because I mean, at least theoretically, politicians are responsive to voters. I mean, they want to stay in power. They have, you know, self-interest to get votes and be liked by their community. So if they think there's a large part of the community who their constituency thinks, you know, we should have no slaughterhouses in Denver, or we should have no caged animals in whatever state, and yeah, they will act that way. Obviously, I think that there's a question of, you know, to what extent do we think political representatives are controlled by vested interests like corporations versus the public, but that's a whole other debate maybe.
You know who I think is actually pretty good at influencing those older adults, their children. children of in these families actually have greater access to these people than I think anybody else.
Wait, so the children of like political representatives you think have strong influence on them, or do you mean children of someone else?
Yeah, I mean, that when we think about influencing the next generation, I'm not just talking about those students eventually getting into positions of power, but actually them having influence on the people in positions of power. And I do know the value of like and I recognize that to a certain extent, like protests and marches have been somewhat devalued, and especially like were not common during the pandemic. But there is something very powerful about people marching and people showing up, and also those students like influencing their families, many of whom, you know, are their parents and grandparents, etc.
Yeah. That makes sense. Cool. Okay. I will push on a tiny bit to speak about organizational leadership, because when you're recommended to us as a guest, the person kind of spoke highly of your approach and how you manage teams and run organizations. And I wonder if you can tell us maybe a tiny bit about how you think about management and running a team and running an organization. And yeah, anything you want to share on those topics?
Sure. I can share that I didn't understand how difficult it was going to be the leader of an organization and just have that ultimate responsibility. And unless you've really been So earlier on in my career, I was like the union rep for like the environmental educators. I walked around Lake Merritt and I saw, you know, signs that said steal from work. And I was like, you know, hating on the man and everything like that. And then I was in the position, right, where I was like, oh, people really think that I'm the man, and I am the man. I got a lot of advice, and the most common advice, and I hope that anybody who's listening who gave me this advice doesn't feel bad, because I'm grateful for the advice, but it was actually pretty terrible, because the advice I was given was don't be an asshole. So it was just like this really simplistic, like, don't be an asshole. And I was like, great. I'm a kind, compassionate, caring person. I'm not an asshole. Everything's going to be lovely. And it wasn't, to really support employees and to like create a culture where people are working optimally, and communicating well, giving each other direct and honest feedback. All that requires, you know, so much structure and so much intentionality. We were paying people so little and basically treating people as volunteers, which did have some impacts on our ability to do our work well, is what I want to say. I know that there are some conversations in our movement around compensation, and I understand that, because I don't believe that compensation is something that you deserve and that should, you know, you're entitled to necessarily. I think of compensation as enabling us to do this work. But with that whole compensation package, right, like there was a time when we didn't offer support for health insurance, as an example. And that really impacted me, because why am I the executive director? Because our founder, the amazing Katie Cantrell, who now runs Greener by Default, she was diagnosed with cancer, right? She had leukemia. It was really scary. So I understand in a country like the United States that healthcare matters. And so suddenly I found myself in the position of having to look up healthcare, having to, you know, manage all these different things from like the state registrations. And what you need to know is like this whole nonprofit structure is ancient. That it wasn't set up for us to be fundraising online. If I have a website, I'm supposed to register in all 50 states individually, many of which have fees and require constant upkeep and require me to, you know, get board members to physically go in and get something notarized, et cetera. Like so much bureaucratic and administrative work. All of which is to say that to be a good manager, it requires so much more than just like, don't be an asshole. And we And I originally thought that as long as I worked very hard, that I would be able to do all of these things. And I am a natural delegator. I don't need to. It's actually uncomfortable for me, James, to, in some ways, to be the face of the organization. I really try and uplift as much as possible all the layers of leadership, the directors, the managers, the coordinators. I don't think that I'm, smarter or even older than anybody else. I do think that we need to push back against a lot of the narratives that the executive director is like the sole face, because that can then lead to many problems down the road, right? When you're thinking about succession planning and, I don't want people to idolize me. I want us to uplift actually the students. That's part of the work that we're doing. So we've had some really good conversations around like creating that culture within the organization where people like feel very empowered and can push back and ask questions.
Nice. Maybe I have, at least I'm just curious, and you said, don't be an asshole, bad advice. So I guess you're saying also like in some cases you've had to be an asshole or whatever to kind of ensure the best outcomes for your staff or for the organization or for animals long term. Is that kind of like something that's emerged as you've done the work?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that I've necessarily embraced being an asshole. That's not what I'm trying to say. I'm just saying like that by itself is not enough. Like just being a kind person is not enough. Like there's so much that you have to do to be a good manager. And also, I don't know if you're familiar with Eric Kaufman's work and, how we talk about ego, but there's this whole like being right, the might and people pleasing, et cetera. And I was socialized, I think, to take care of people. When something was wrong, I just sort of like dealt with it as opposed to like really giving the direct and honest feedback that was necessary. So I've grown significantly over the last 4 years, and you'll see that really reflected in our values. Our values used to be things like compassion. And it's like, who's against compassion? It wasn't even unique to us as an organization. But if you look at our values now, which do very directly mention ego so that we can talk about ego, talk about caring, accountability, right? What does accountability look like and also be caring at the same time? Those are things that we talk about very regularly, and our staff do DNA journals where we reflect on how we're living those values.
Tell me more about that. So how often do they reflect in those journals? And so they speak about is like, I guess, organizational DNA. So like, to what extent is New Roots Institute keeping true to the values it set out? Is that kind of what people do?
Yeah. And just, these are what I love about our DNA also is that we're talking about DEIJ without ever mentioning DEIJ.
Yeah. Do you want to explain what that means? Because not everyone knows the American acronym, at least.
I know, right? In the United States, at least, there's been a really strong emphasis on diversity, equity, inclusion. And then there was this document going around like white supremacy in organizations. And so, we were dealing with that. By the way, I have a lot to say about it. But separately, what I wanted to say is that we created these values and that we call our DNA because it's so central to who we are as an organization. It includes things like fierce competence, and it includes things like caring, accountability. And we have to talk about them very regularly and be very intentional about them. And this is what I'm saying about how it can't just be, don't be an asshole, because I didn't understand when I first became a leader how intentional I needed to be around the culture.
And that's because, whether you like it or not, everyone else in the organization kind of looks to you as the source of kind of the culture and how people should act. And therefore, you need to model like what you want everyone else to kind of be like. Is that right?
I mean, I do try my very best to model it. But also, we have these layers of leadership. And that means that, we have a whole profile for what layers of leadership mean. It's everything from speaking with one voice to, really taking extreme ownership at each of our different levels. So even though I'm and we are a hierarchical organization, which is a whole nother thing that we had to deal with, right? Because originally every single employee reported to me and we didn't have this actual structure. Yeah. So when I say to how don't be an asshole was terrible advice, like it did not prep me for all these like major org changes that needed to happen. And I really want to give credit to Andreas Setzer of Know Your Elephants, because without his support, I don't think that we would have really gone to where we are. Another key value that I think is important for us to mention is ready adaptation. And we have had to adapt so much, right? So I became the executive director right before the pandemic. And when the pandemic hit, all of our programming basically disappeared. And that we've talked about how we were FFAC 1.0 and then 2.0 during the pandemic and things were changing. 3.0 when we started to, you know, work with Andreas and, you know, change our org structure and our culture. And now we're New Roots 1.0. And there's very much this understanding that we're going to keep on changing. We're going to keep on adapting because we don't do this work in a vacuum. And I've seen a lot of organizations really struggle to embrace that ready adaptation, not just in terms of, you know, their work, but culturally, because there's so much going on politically and so many conversations ranging from like Me Too to, you know, Black Lives Matter, et cetera. And it's been difficult, I think, for a lot of organizations to really be in a position to move forward as an organization.
Mm. Cool. Well, there's a lot to unpack there, but that sounds crazy that when you took over, you were just like, everyone's reporting to you, and then the pandemic, and what did you do when, you know, your whole theory of change is more or less kind of like now illegal to some degree, or like impossible because you can't meet in public? What did you guys end up doing, and yeah, how was that experience for you?
Yeah, it forced us to innovate. We, to, you know, a certain degree of success, moved some things online. And we also really grew our leadership program and the curriculum for that. And I'm very proud of the leadership program at this point. I don't think anybody else.
So leadership for activists. So like just train the students to become activists.
Yeah.
Got it.
200 students I was talking about this year. Yeah. So over the years now, I think we have over 400 alums of that program that are doing really exciting work. And that includes, you know, someone like Noah Dalzell of Food. And you probably know Noah, right? Working somewhat in connection with her and the lobbying that they're doing.
Okay.
And some state government, or the students who are like, you know, work at Pete's Coffee and then are just able to like get meetings with corporate headquarters. I know that our curriculum is really strong. And part of what I want to do is make sure that other organizations are able to leverage that. And this includes internationally as well. If there is an organization in Africa, Peru, Brazil, and we're talking to a lot of them and supporting them right now, you don't need to start your own like student program. Like, we can train these students and then they can do the project work with you.
Mm. That's very cool. Yeah. So then I guess you do follow up with a bunch of the people that come through the fellowship program, and like, do you tend to see a bunch of them getting kind of like pro-animal-y jobs, or is it just like, they take their pro-animal views and kind of go anywhere, and that helps thing? Or is it you are actually pushing them towards like the animal-focused organizations?
I don't think that we necessarily push them towards the animal-focused organizations, because for two reasons. One is that the animal-focused organizations can't accept another 400 people in entry-level positions right now.
Yeah.
Right. Mm. Like, we just don't have that capacity. And I do think that it is really important for that student to be working at the NRDC, which has historically not focused on anti-factory farming. And it's helpful for us when we're coordinating. And I've heard many people in our movement talk about the struggle of working with environmental organizations and them not, you know, us giving so much and, you know, the environmental organizations not prioritizing like animals, et cetera. Again, we need people on the inside.
Yeah. And for context, NRDC is the National Resources Defense Council, right? Which is one of the main mm-hmm. US green nonprofits.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I don't know. In terms of if you now had to give advice to someone else who's going to become a executive director or leader of an organization, what would you give them?
Well, this is a big question and kind of relates to if you had asked me earlier what my most controversial opinion is. I want to be really careful in how I say this because it's so nuanced. I think that there are a lot of organizations right now, potentially too many organizations, that are not coordinated and the entire movement is trying desperately hard to support, and sometimes not very successfully. So when a student comes to me or any very passionate person with an idea for an organization, I don't just say, that's amazing, go for it. And just be like this super encouraging person, because I recognize that there is so much work that they haven't yet thought about and really necessarily planned for. So I wanna make sure that when you're starting an organization, you've really done your homework, you've done the strategic planning that's necessary. You might have seen one of my talks earlier that I did with Apex and 50 by 40 when it existed around fundraising. People are always talking about hiring grant writers. And for small organizations, I'm like, no, what you need to do is do a landscape analysis. You need to do a SWOT analysis. You need to be super clear on what you do and take that language from the strategic plan. And then you can copy and paste. You're not trying to get funding. Like, you don't just work on a grant and then you work on a grant. It's like completely different. It's really like the core language of your organization that's really key to develop. And then you, of course, have to be thinking about all the administrative work of running an organization. And I think that our society glorifies for-profit startup culture. And I say this as somebody who grew up in Silicon Valley, right, which is that section of California where a lot of the tech startups in particular come from. And in startup for-profit culture, if, you know, you try, you fail, either way, it's very celebrated. The only harm potentially is to investors. And in our movement, especially one as small as ours, I just really think that we need to be coordinating and strategizing. So, again, when a person comes to me and says, I want to start an organization, I just really want to make sure that they've done their homework. And that's actually the first way in which I'm supportive, as I ask those questions. I try and get them to like really think about what's going to happen in the future.
You think sometimes, or even currently, there's just, you know, there's many different organizations where relatively small movement in comparison to other stuff, you know, our global funding is, you know, around $200 to $300 million a year. And so you think, rather than just trying to constantly incubate new stuff because, oh, look, there's this shiny new strategy that could be cool, we should think quite deeply, like, okay, who else is doing this? What's been tried before? Do I need a new organization? And then can assess rather than just diving head first. Is that right?
Yeah. And could this organization exist as a program of another organization? Like, just exploring that. I'm not saying that that's going to be exactly how it is, but can you imagine if I said to every single one of our alums, hey, after this, I want you to start your own nonprofit organization and encourage them to do that? We'd have another 400 organizations that are all competing for funding and haven't really thought through, you know, all the things that make it so hard to run an organization.
Okay, cool. That's useful. Well, but I'm still curious for management advice to someone who is, let's say, taking over an established charity. Let's say it's good, things are going well, they're already up and going, they're not going to like fold or whatever. What advice would you give them in terms of management and leadership?
I'm trying to think about what has been most salient. You know, some people have emphasized that I'm a chief repetition officer, a CRO, and I say the same things over and over again, and that's what needs to happen. For me, I really wanted so hard to be understood. And the thing is that I have so much information that, you know, as an employer, you have to keep confidentiality on certain things. And I think that runs contrary to a lot of ideas around transparency. So what I am often able to do is help people get to understand a little bit about like why I made the decision, even if they disagree with it. And that's something that is really important for, I think, a leader to understand, is that people will disagree with you and that is okay. Yeah. I also have learned some really big lessons recently that maybe I can share here, which is that I was sort of raised to be impactful in the sense that from a very young age, my family members told me a lot about how terrible the world is. And I took that in and I knew that it, you know, part of the reason that I'm on this planet is to, you know, do the best that I can to coordinate people, to affect change. And so many people have made sacrifices for me to be able to do this. I realized recently that all of my grandparents, family members, et cetera, they'd be really sad if I was just making an impact and I wasn't happy. And it's been interesting for me to, honestly, just in the last few weeks, to really try and prioritize joy separate from work and realize that like that joy and happiness is a part of like the reason why I'm a human being on this planet and part of my role. So I mean, as I look back at the last 4 years, like I've given everything that I could to this organization, like, you know, and there are successes externally. People can recognize that our team has grown, our budget has grown, revenue has increased, our impact has grown, etc. And I also know that, like, am I a billionaire? Did I have those connections? No. Like there's just like so many things that like as much as I tried, that this is truly the best that I could do. And as I think about, you know, the next few years of the organization and making sure that I'm able to continue doing this work, like I do need to prioritize that joy separate from work and not necessarily because it will help me be a better leader.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point because people sometimes make the instrumental case for, you know, having a good life, which is, oh, actually, if you have a good life, you'll be more productive and good at your other work, or you can sustain yourself in your work for longer and it's actually like higher impact. But you're saying there's, besides the instrumental case, there's like an intrinsic value, obviously, to like, this stuff is just important and good for you, and was just, I guess, important in and of itself rather than for other purposes. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. And for some people, that might just be the most basic duh thing that anybody could have ever said. But for me, quite revelatory.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, I think in the animal rights world, I think obviously people are so rightly, you know, when you look out, the world seems so awful and all the sad things and how many animals are affected. You think, wow, I have to commit everything and it's unreasonable for me to be happy if when there's so much suffering. So I think it's actually a pretty like normal view, at least some of the hardcore animal rights folks. So yeah, I think it's not too surprising.
Yeah, and I also, and when I was 18 years old and watching Earthlings, everybody said that I needed to, and for those of you who don't know, Earthlings is a really graphic documentary about how animals are exploited. And I was told I needed to watch that every single year so that I would stay motivated. And I know, right? And at this point, I'm like, I don't need to watch Earthlings every single year to stay motivated. I have, and it's actually been many years since I've watched Earthlings, and here I am still doing it. I know that I already have this compulsion, right? We talked about like, do we do nothing or do we at least try? And you know how that defines us and who we are and how we perceive ourselves. I already trust myself and my ability to care very deeply about this work and to stay motivated. So I don't need to hold on to that pain all the time in order to do this work. But I thought that I did.
I don't know who coined this. Maybe it's Melanie Joy. Maybe it's like almost like secondary traumatic. Like it's like basically like constantly re-traumatizing ourselves by over stimulation of some of the most graphic stuff. It's probably not good for us long term. And yeah, you're right. I think if you don't need it, you shouldn't feel obliged to do that because it's just not going to be good for you. Basically, cool. So then, if we just move on to I guess some closing questions, and hopefully maybe some lighter topics. What's a bit of news that you're grateful about or excited about recently?
So the bit of news that I'm going to share is probably not going to be exciting at face value, but at the end of August, the Washington Post University of Maryland poll came out and they asked the respondents to share what if they thought that eating meat or dairy would have an effect on climate change. And 75% said that not eating meat or dairy would have little or no effect on climate change. So that means that people do not know the impacts of industrial animal agriculture on climate change. And I take that to be very exciting news that reinforces that we need to be doing this work and this education and culture shift work.
That's funny. I was reading that article and I was like, this feels like bad news to me. But actually, you're right. It's like, no, if people actually have kind of like misinformed views about the world that hopefully we can correct in a reasonably straightforward way and then they'll change their behavior. That sounds great, right? If that is the case.
I know. Well, that's kind of the beauty of this because when we go into these classrooms, we're actually talking about things that are in line with people's values, right? Like we're not trying to change people into being like hateful, which is considered a bad thing. People want to be good. They want to be having an impact and supporting good things. So this is a way for us to connect to that.
Nice, very cool. Okay, we will link that poll in the show notes because, yeah, it's surprising. Not meeting meat was third from the bottom and not eating dairy was the very bottom thing in terms of, you know, small impact on climate change amongst like 10 things that are asked. So surprising, actually. Cool. And then in terms of media recommendations for people to listen to either hear more about stuff we spoke about or things you find interesting for your worldview, yeah, what would you recommend?
The first is titled An Integrative Framework for Transformative Social Change, A Case in Global Wildlife Trade, which came out in the Sustainability Science Journal, and the authors were Nato, Zhao, and Chan. I think that this one's really important to read because it heavily informed our theory of change, and I think that that has big impacts potentially on our whole movement-wide theory of change, so I would encourage folks to read that.
I think you're probably the second person that's recommended an academic journal. I think the first one was Neil, came out recently. So it's good having some nice academic informed theories of change. It's great.
Yes, I am making a lot of assumptions about your audience.
I think that they'll be into this.
Okay.
We'll definitely link it so people can have a read.
Okay. On the other side, for the folks that maybe don't want to read an academic journal, I have found the Forge organizing articles to be really enlightening. So Maurice Mitchell wrote one on building resilient organizations, and then another one on how not to dismantle white supremacy. And they have been really key in informing some of the discussions that I've had, not just on my team, but with other leaders in our movement as well. Because again, we're not doing our animal rights work in a vacuum. We're doing it with a whole lot of other like socio-political forces. So I think that these are helpful.
Okay, these are great recommendations. I've also read some really good pieces on the Forge Organizing website. So I would recommend that people interested in broadly like grassroots activism, social movements broadly, that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's very cool. I think they have some really good deep dives on the Sunrise Movement as well that I've read. Cool. And then how can people get more involved in your work, and where can they find you online or otherwise?
Yes, so please reach out to us. We're at newrootsinstitute.org. All of our social media handles are at New Roots Institute. And I do hope that people who are listening to this podcast reach out to me. I would love to connect. From what I understand of your listenership, if you know people who are educators and can help bring us into classrooms, please connect us. If you are a student, consider encouraging them to apply to our fellowship program. And if you are thinking about how we are going to end factory farming and want to be a part of this conversation, I would be very interested in connecting with you. It's also important to just show support for each other and to network. Part of the reason why we became New Roots Institute is because, you know, roots connect, they communicate, they grow. And for our students, right, they are sometimes feeling very alone. And what we're trying to help them understand is that they're not just one voice, that they have this whole community supporting them behind them. And that's really critical right now because the pandemic really did have a very big impact on student mental health. And as I shared earlier, when I became vegetarian, it was because I met somebody. I became vegan because I met somebody. I became an advocate because I met somebody. Like, you need to feel like you're not just one voice. So I hope that other people will join us and help us, you know, just grow this network more broadly.
Nice. Very cool. Okay, well, actually, last question, because I realized I didn't ask it, and it's probably kind of important, is how can we change your name?
Well, I mean, you've just heard me share this whole story of our evolution from the 4 years ago, right, where everybody was reporting to me, where everybody just did presentations, to now where we've got these integrated programs where you have, and where our lessons are completely different from the presentations that we gave before. So really, it represents not just like a name change, but a recognition of the evolution of our organization. And in terms of the actual name itself, Factory Farming Awareness Coalition is a really long name that most people, including my board members, do not say correctly. We're often Factory Farm or like Factory Farm Aware Coalition, whatever, like various.
I call you guys for FAC sometimes. I don't know if that's meant to be intentional, but.
And being called for FAC was also not really great. I'd say also that it was difficult for us to get into schools. Right? Like, we came across as such a strong advocacy organization. To a certain extent, we could have been called like the Go Vegan organization. And people have, as I mentioned, a lot of stereotypes about animal advocacy work. So for us to be able to go into just a random environmental science class, like, it helps to have a more neutral name. And for us to, and it's very true for us, like, we are an organization that cares about all these other impacts of factory farming, and not just on the animals directly on themselves. Like, the environmental impacts also connect to the animals, but like, yes, we are an environmental organization as well. So New Roots Institute really gives us the credibility that we need as an organization to get into schools and get past the teachers who are our gatekeepers. And it also represents that we are, you know, a new organization, not the same organization as FFAC, and that we are groundswelling and that we play a really integral role in our movement now.
Nice. Well, that is a great place to end. So yeah, thank you so much, Monica. That's been a really interesting chat about like lots of different topics, lots of things from very high level to very niche. So yeah, thank you for coming on. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, James. I think this represents every conversation we've ever had.
Bits and pieces of it, yeah. Yes. Anyway, thank you.